drilling on 3,000 acres outside Haymarket, Virginia, most of it owned by Exxon, which had abandoned ambitious development plans during the 1991 recession. The tract was 20 miles from Washington, adjacent to Hunt Country, and just 5 miles from the historic Manassas Civil War battlefield. In its determination to capture the complexity of the American experience throughout its history, Disney's America may have been Eisner's most ambitious undertaking, intellectually if not logistically. In January 1994, he convened an all-day meeting with Rummel and the Imagineers. "The most difficult job," he told them, "won't be to tell important stories about our history or to deliver an enjoyable experience for our guests, but to achieve both these goals without having either one dilute the other. We need to keep working to create a day-long experience that makes our guests laugh and cry, feel proud of their country's strengths, and angry about its shortcomings." Some Imagineers thought it was too great a burden for a theme park to carry. So, the idea of a working steel mill, which guests would view from the perspective of a roller coaster running through it, was scrapped as an inherently inconsistent hybrid of thrills and education. So, too, was a Lewis and Clark whitewater raft ride against the backdrop of Manifest Destiny. Nevertheless, the Imagineers developed ambitious plans for 7 themed areas, including a Native American village, a Civil War fort, Ellis Island, a state fair, and a working family farm. Eager to attract a major potential tourist attraction, the Virginia legislature approved a $140 million bond issue to finance highway improvements and a $20 million marketing campaign to promote Virginia tourism. As in France, Disney could dangle the possibility of a theme park in return for substantial public benefits. Of course, many of Euro Disney's shareholders and creditors were now regretting their eagerness to entice Disney to a site outside of Paris. Despite Eisner's public warnings that the lenders had to accept their fair share of the losses, and that Disney would consider letting Euro Disney go bankrupt if necessary, the European lenders had been intransigent, saying that salvaging the park was Disney's responsibility. As general counsel, Litvak reported to Wells, but had been complaining to Eisner that Wells hadn't given him sufficient responsibility. Given Eisner's tendency to blame Wells for Euro Disney's problems, this fell on sympathetic ears, and Eisner encouraged Litvak to take on the lead negotiating role in Paris. When a lawyer for the lenders threatened to sue Disney for fraud based on the representations it made at the time of the original financing, Litvak was so angry that he made only a brief rebuttal, then walked out and boarded a plane for Los Angeles, refusing to continue negotiations. Litvak's dramatic gesture broke the logjam. Negotiations soon resumed, and Litvak arrived at an agreement that essentially divided the burden of reducing the debt by $1 billion among Disney and the lenders. Among other provisions, it gave Euro Disney a reprieve by suspending interest payments for 16 months and deferring principal payments for 3 years. "Close the deal as best you can," Wells told Litvak. Soon after, an anxious Philippe Bourguignon interrupted Steve Burke, who was in the middle of a meeting, and took him into a small room. "Our phones have been tapped," he reported. The offices had been swept for listening devices. "Yours and mine have been tapped. We don't know by whom or for how long.